طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح. طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, from a perspective all too lacking in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. The times are devastating for Palestinians, as we know from the stream of news stories that report how particularly young people, in their desperation, living under the suffocation of Israeli military occupation, are increasingly deciding to take their stand against this military oppression by lashing out with random stabbings and assaults on Israeli citizens and even the military. Most of these assaults lead to the death of the Palestinian, as the stated Israeli policy is to shoot to kill in such instances. This really is a form of suicide, a choice by young Palestinians who see no future for themselves and finally decide to make a final act of resistance through martyrdom. It is a tragic sign of these desperate times for the youth of Palestine. The response of the Israeli military is to clamp down even more dramatically by raising the level of collective punishment on the Palestinian people. More checkpoints, more house demolitions, more land confiscation, more restrictions on travel, more violent responses to nonviolent demonstrations. Recently, Palestinian activist Nancy Murray returned from Israel, having led a delegation for the Interfaith Peace Builders. Nancy has been a frequent traveler to Palestine for two decades, and therefore is uniquely qualified to help us gain some perspective on the current difficult times in the Middle East. We sat down with Nancy to get her take on conditions in Palestine following her recent trip, and also to discuss her work locally with the Boston Alliance for Water Justice. Nancy, thank you for speaking with us on This Week in Palestine. You're recently back from yet another delegation, yes, leading a delegation for Interfaith Peace Builders. I understand there were several local Bostonians on the trip.
Well, mainly from Massachusetts, not so much from Boston. We did have another Cambridge resident, but most of our 10 representatives of Massachusetts were from other cities outside.
Okay. Yeah. Tell us the purpose of the trip. What did you expect to accomplish, or what were you hoping to do?
This is the 55th delegation organized by Interfaith Peace Builders. And they have a very clear purpose. They don't want people just to go and look as voyeurs. They want people to be active on their return. So there is a two-day training process before people go, in which they learn about the issue. They get packets of reading material. Then they learn more about the issue. They learn about what to expect at the airport. They learn about how to begin to think about interfacing with the media, with Congress people on their return. This trip had 35 people on it, so it was very large. As I said, 10 were from Massachusetts. There were a group from California, and then the rest were scattered. But we keep in touch. So on our return, since we've been back, we have been encouraging each other to write articles, reading each other's pieces, sharing articles. So for at least a year, there's intense back and forth among members. I led a trip with Interfaith Peace Builders 2 years ago, and that group still keeps in touch with each other. So it is a group that is not just going as a kind of leisure sport. I mean, they know they're making a commitment.
There's a purpose.
There's a purpose. And they know that they're expected to share the stories, to try to talk to friends, not just friends, but in our case we had five ministers, pastors with us. So they were thinking of how they could reach out to their congregations. Others were more activists from other struggles. Nicaragua, you know, sort of 80s struggles, the Iraq War, and this was their first visit to Palestine. In many cases, people came with some background, but not having visited. But in some cases, they had very little background. And I must say, it doesn't take long to begin to see what's going on. And I would say by, you know, within a few days, everyone was pretty much up to speed.
Right. Well, you're a frequent traveler to Israel, Palestine. In fact, how many times have you made this trip?
Well, I haven't kept count, but this might have been the 14th or the 15th since 1988.
You started in 88.
One. Yeah.
What was it like this time as compared to other times in terms of your ability to travel and pass through checkpoints?
Mm. Yeah, well, we could travel because we had a yellow license plate, i.e. a license plate from East Jerusalem, which is different from a West Bank license plate. So we could go through the faster lanes of checkpoints. That didn't mean that we didn't at times get stopped. When we crossed from the West Bank into Israel at the Jalame checkpoint, which is up near Jenin, we not only got stopped, we were all taken off the bus, we had all of our luggage searched, and our cameras taken apart, and they then gassed the bus. This is a new procedure. They bring over some kind of a gadget that pumps vehicles, and they were doing it to cars as well, full of gas. In the case of a bus, it took quite a long time. And, you know, no explanation what they were doing, but we waited there for a half an hour watching them do it, and apparently it was to detect some sort of bombs. So we did get, you know, because we had been in the West Bank, we got that treatment. But in terms of what Palestinians go through, our yellow license plate helped us avoid the worst of the delays and the worst kind of treatment that they get routinely.
But this was unique to this trip, this kind of a search?
No, I mean, generally speaking, whenever I go, since they've created all these checkpoints, you get searched in some capacity. But now, given the time frame and what's happening there, you could never predict when you will be stopped. At one stage in this trip, we were at Kalandia checkpoint, which your listeners may know is a very large one separating Ramallah from Jerusalem. And some of our group wanted the experience of walking through the checkpoint. So they got off the bus, and you know they were going to walk through. We then get a taxi on the other side. So we expected to see them much later at the hotel than the group that stayed on the bus. We thought that they would go through with relatively little trouble. Well, what happened was the bus went through with relatively little trouble and then got to another so-called flying checkpoint, which hadn't been there in the morning. But because some kids had thrown stones at cars, we were there for 3 hours. The bus just was stopped with no word of explanation. And this is what travel is like now. Around the West Bank and into East Jerusalem. You don't know if you'll get to appointments. You don't know how long it will take or if, in fact, you will be able to succeed in accessing a particular neighborhood of East Jerusalem or a particular village in the West Bank. I mean, it's just all very random and impromptu. And in addition to these massive transit places that have been established since Oslo, there are now, you know, hundreds of these other obstacles and checkpoints.
And in terms of the folks you met with there, were there any common themes? Was there something you heard again and again and again?
Again and again. You know, since I was last there 2 years ago, I was struck by when we met with Israelis, the remnants of the peace movement, that is, boycott from within, new profile, these groups, I was struck by how exhausted they looked and how deeply depressed they were by their own society, by the fact that the racism in Israel was becoming so blatant and so out of control, and the hatred directed not just against Palestinians and so-called Arabs, but against them, was really clearly very hard to deal with because they were standing out against government policies. Within the West Bank, it was, you know, people are struggling. They're still fighting. They're not giving up hope. But the sense of total despair in their own leadership, I mean, there is no leadership, that was certainly a theme, the feeling that, you know, here they were. They can't get a sense of direction from leaders because there aren't any. They've been corralled into these tiny areas which prevent them from moving and organizing across the West Bank. At the same time, and they're seeing, you know, settlements just, you know, galloping along, more and more land being taken, more and more water resources being taken. So there's this sense of, you know, how are we going to stop this? Now, that doesn't mean people have given up. In Hebron, which is perhaps one of the most depressing places one could go, it's a virtual ghost city in the H2 region, which is the region around the mosque, which in 1994, that's the mosque that Baruch Goldstein from the settlement Kiryat Arba entered and killed 29 praying Muslims. And as a response to that, Israel basically put the entire area under curfew, and it has not really changed. It's been under intense restrictions ever since.
And the settlers are particularly aggressive in Hebron.
Incredibly aggressive, because they have the total upper hand. We even heard that there was some Israeli army general there who they felt was being too friendly with shopkeepers, and so they ordered him to be replaced, and he was. But even there, which was the bleakest possible place, you know, we met with Issa Amro of Youth Against Settlements, who has been arrested 16 times this year, hundreds of times in all, and yet he is determined to carry on with his nonviolent resistance. And he really does believe that in the end, because the cause is so just, it will prevail. And so when you meet people like that, it really makes you feel you cannot be in despair. But it's hard, you know, just looking at the place and remembering what it was like when I first saw it, 1988, how much has gone against the Palestinians. It's hard not to feel, you know, unless the world wakes up, you know, this is just going to continue and continue, and Palestinians are paying a very high price.
And what about what about Bethlehem and the Aida camp? That's another flashpoint.
Yes.
And, of course, we have many, many friends in Bethlehem and in the Aida camp. And
right. Well, and that's, again, another place where you just wonder how people endure, because it has been bathed in tear gas. This is Aida camp in particular, in the area of Bethlehem around Rachel's tomb, which is now an army camp. I mean, not just tear gas. It's like cascading poisonous chemicals that have just enveloped the camp.
And why is Aida camp such a flashpoint?
Well, it's a flashpoint because it's bang up against the wall. There is this army base very nearby at Rachel's tomb, and kids throw stones as an expression of resistance to what has become of their, you know, hopes for a future. And so, you know, they have been playing a cat and mouse game with the soldiers. When we were there, on top of the Laji Center roof, the soldiers came and fired tear gas, which enveloped us, and we got a little taste of what Palestinians have to live with the whole time. Arrests of, you know, recently a six-year-old was detained in the Aida camp. This is not unusual. They came in recently, they left, but they came in and planted themselves on the roof where we had been standing when we were tear gassed. They put a Israeli flag up, you know, and that's just to taunt the kids. Yeah, so it's a kind of ongoing, you know, cat and mouse, because the Palestinians are not going to say we give up. You know, they do sense that they have the right of resistance. And resistance in this case means they are going to let Israel know any way they can that they are not going to submit to the occupation. So if it's a matter of kids throwing stones or writing on the wall, which, you know, the huge separation wall surrounds Ida Camp, they will write on the wall.
Yeah.
In one case, they, you know, burned the wall. They tried to make a hole in the wall. You know, these are the kinds of acts that Israel then comes, the Israeli army comes, you know, roaring in and, you know, tries to really, well, succeeds in intimidating and injuring and arresting and in some cases killing camp residents. And that is an ongoing issue, an ongoing sort of pattern, which is not changing. It's getting worse as these months go by since October.
And what about in the old city, the military presence in the old city, which can be very, very heavy at times?
Yeah. Well, it was an interesting experience going there because we went there on our first day. And, you know, here I was with a group of Americans, most of whom had not been there before, and they thought, this isn't, you know, we thought it would be more tourist, but this is, this seems kind of peaceful. Well, the reason they thought it seemed peaceful was because there was no one around. I mean, they did not understand that, you know, people were not out in the streets because they are afraid of the army. They are afraid with this impunity with which soldiers are shooting. You know, if somebody holds up something that looks like it could be, you know, a device, like a weapon or a, might be a pair of glasses, you know, who knows? Mm. They could get shot. So, you know, once they understood that this is not the normal pace of life in the old city, you know, they kind of started looking with other eyes. One thing that surprised me was how many settlers there are in the old city now. You know, it used to be when Sharon made his provocative entry into that one building in East and hung his flag. You know, that was putting a stake in the ground. Well, now, you know, it's
all over.
Yeah, it's riddled with little settlements.
Mm-hmm.
So,
which is the plan?
But we were there at a time when a lot of East Jerusalem's neighborhoods had been completely cordoned off because of knife attacks. The army had been routinely raiding hospitals. In October, they had conducted 7 raids on hospitals, including 4 on Makassar Hospital, the major hospital. And when I say raids, I mean, this includes doing something they just did again, which is shooting tear gas into hospitals. Now, in Hebron, the day after we left, they went one better than shooting tear gas, and they actually came into the hospital with an undercover group pretending to be taking a pregnant woman to have a baby. And then they pull out their weapons, they arrested this wounded guy who had been in one of the wards, and then they just killed his cousin when he was leaving the bathroom where he had gone to
right in the hospital
prayer. In the hospital, they just shoot spray bullets, blood and gore everywhere inside the hospital. So these are the kind of acts that are happening now with very little attention from the mainstream media, but much more attention from the social media. So you could understand why the Israeli deputy foreign minister went to see Google and YouTube and suggest that they work together to censor these.
Right.
Now, Google has said, well, it was strongly described. They didn't come to any agreement that she had just come to meet with them. But who knows? I mean, these are things, you know, now that is a lifeline for Palestinians to be able to get out these images and to get out their stories that way, because the mainstream media has been so lamentably uninterested.
Now, is there much pushback concerning Google on this, something we really need to do?
Well, Google did, I read on Alternate, that Google did issue a statement saying that it was just meeting with the deputy foreign minister to explain what mechanisms they have to retrieve, you know, material from the internet that shouldn't be there. But they say they didn't come to any agreement to have this cooperative plan. We'll have to see.
We'll have to see, but it seems to me that if Google gets tagged with a censorship tag, it could be enormously problematic for them.
Oh, yeah. Because, and I think they must.
Yeah, I mean, Google, you know, we depend on, you know, yeah. we depend on the internet for precisely this kind of thing. And now when we begin to understand that perhaps we're not going to get everything, or that's not going
to
happen.
Right. Well, we have to keep an eye and see how much, if things get blocked. But let me give you one example. So YouTube was the other agency that was named in this. Now, YouTube has had some videos go viral. One was that amazing one in Nabi Saleh where a Israeli soldier arrested the 12-year-old son
yes.
with his arm in a cast.
That went viral.
Yes,
oh, yeah.
of Bassam Tamimi. So, and then the wife of Tamimi and daughter kind of beat off the soldier. Now, the interesting thing is what hasn't got so much attention is that since then, 20 youth from Nabi Saleh have been arrested. It seems to me that it must be in a kind of revenge by the army. Okay, you think you could, you know, mess
yeah.
with us. Well, so these 20 young men, this is only a village of 500 people, and they've now, you know, been imprisoned and they've been interrogated. And in Israel, as we heard from Physicians for Human Rights and as we heard from Adamir, that includes still very harsh and abusive treatment, sometimes rising to torture under interrogation. And, you know, it's just awful that that has not gone viral,
yeah.
news of that.
We hear disturbing things about the role of the Palestinian Authority in Palestinian society. What can you tell us about their current place in Palestinian society, how they're viewed? We have to put this against the history of Oslo, where the Palestinian Authority was gradually to take over the control of the West Bank.
Until 2000.
There were going to be land swaps, and the Israeli military was going to, you know, gradually relinquish control.
Yeah.
What's happened to that?
Well, let me just say that this is one of the, you know, as well as the fact you can no longer move freely as you could in 1988, this is one of the great sadnesses I have. Because in 1988, during the First Intifada, wherever you would go, there would be little kids chanting, PLO, PLO. There was such a sense that they had a leadership. Now, you go to Ramallah, there are these giant buildings that purport to be government buildings, Ministry of the Interior, Justice, and so on. Palestinians do not feel like they have a government right now. They know there is an authority, which in many cases is the only job in town. You know, you have to work for the authority, get
it's
a salary.
Immense piece of the economy.
Of the economy. And so for that reason, they don't really want it to disappear, many of them, overnight. But in terms of what else it is doing, they know that the security forces of the authority are working with Israel. They collaborate in terms of intelligence. They collaborate in terms of, you know, pinpointing people for arrest. And I thought back to something I wrote shortly after the Oslo Accords were signed in 1994. I remember writing an article describing the Oslo Accords as apartheid with joint patrols. And I think, you know, we have apartheid system, and we do still have joint patrols. Because even though President Abbas went to the UN and said Oslo is over, as far as I understand, they have not cut collaboration in terms of security forces. And I think Israel is very worried about this, if they ever were to cut this collaboration. Because,
but then the money would go, probably.
Yes, so they're trying everything to prevent it from happening. But the fact of the matter is, the PA security forces have been trained in the use of weapons. They have weapons. And if they ever decided, the Tanzim, if they ever did decide to not carry on with the kind of Oslo formula of working in, you know, areas A and B to, you know, help Israel manage the occupation, then there would be real trouble. I think Israel is really afraid of that. The people look at what's happening with the PA. They know about the corruption. They know about the terrible treatment of dissidents. The PA has been just awful in what it does under interrogation to Hamas right. people, to any all the factions that are not with them, in their view. And, you know, they really do say this has to go. But on the other hand, they can't afford for it to go because then, you know, they're afraid of the alternative, which is chaos, which is no money coming in at all, which is no jobs, no livelihood. So it's a very, very, very difficult thing.
Very difficult.
And yeah.
What's also problematic for the Palestinian people is this whole prospect of no elections, of yeah. their having no role in choosing their government. And when we had elections,
yeah.
The United States and Israel didn't like the way they came out because right. Hamas gained control of yes. some areas, and so they just discounted the elections.
Yeah.
And so Abbas continues, and there doesn't seem to be anything on the horizon that would be a signal to the Palestinian people that they have any choice in choosing any new leadership.
Right. No, it's true. I mean, people, though, okay, at the moment, that the horizon looks like there's no light. But people, I think, are feeling this cannot go on. I mean, you mm-hmm. can't have a system, a situation like this endure forever. Now, it's clear one reason it can't go on is because Abbas is getting very old.
Right.
But then what do you have waiting in the wings? I mean, clearly the CIA was working with Dahlan before to stick him into Gaza, and he's clearly maneuvering to become a new strong man if... But, you know, he's hated. And so there's a lot of different jostling behind the scenes that probably I certainly don't know about. But it'll be interesting. I mean, the situation is not sustainable for long. So I would say in the next few years, something will emerge. The question is what? I mean, we could no longer... I think Palestinians are... not hoping for salvation through one strong man or one leader. Many young Palestinians are hoping that struggles that are organized from the grassroots can bear fruit. The problems are enormous because of all the divide and rule tactics that have gone on and because of the multiple hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of barriers and restrictions that prevent people from organizing and talking and meeting each other. So it's not easy, but individuals who are involved at the grassroots level are not giving up.
It's difficult because Israel knows how to work collaborators. They get people and they prey on their vulnerabilities, they yeah. threaten their families. And right. if any of us put ourselves in their positions,
yeah.
you know, what would we do? It's so who do you trust in the Palestinian society
yeah.
and where are the leverages on people? It's just...
It is. And so in one sense, you have to look at what's happening within Israel itself and think, well, that's not sustainable either because it's going so... far in the direction of this barbaric, racist, the kinds of laws that are being proposed and passed, mm-hmm. and also this notion that Palestinians are not human beings. Now, this is not new. I remember in 1988 and 1999, you know, the terrible racism directed against Palestinians was on the walls. It was in the Israeli press. Israel Shahak used to translate from the Hebrew press and send these accounts of what, you know, was being said, and it was pretty shocking. Mm. But now there's no attempt to hide it at all
right.
within government circles, and they really are pushing for the kinds of laws I think they couldn't get away with then. And so everything is much more overtly racist and extreme. And a lot of Israelis are worried about the fact that people who can't stomach this are leaving.
Yes.
So sooner or later, you know, Israel has got to look at itself. Is this the kind of country we want to
be? Right. As bad as conditions are in Palestine, There are those such as Columbia Professor Rashid Khalidi and Ali Abu Nima and the Electronic Intifada, and others who see support for Israel beginning to crumble in the United States. And they look at the campuses, they even look at the vote on the Iran nuclear deal that perhaps indicates that Netanyahu has overplayed his hand. They're seeing such indicators as the Jewish lobby really losing in a big way on this vote, AIPAC losing in a big way on the Iran vote. And that is significant in terms of beginning to drive some cracks in this powerful Israeli lobby. So there seem to be some hopeful signs even here, or do you think we're grasping at straws on this?
Well, as far as the lobby goes, I've always been someone who thinks that you got to look at the big geopolitical picture. And it's true, they lost on Iran. But, you know, Israel is succeeding because of the support of the U.S. in all sorts of other ways in the region. So the militarization of the whole region with Israel and the U.S. hand in hand, and the way, they've succeeded in breaking down strong governments, I mean, both Iraq and Syria, is, you know, pretty astonishing. So I think that still, you know, we're not going to have the Pentagon decide to cut Israel loose. And the question is always, how do you translate a change in U.S. policy? I agree that there is a very different picture now on campuses. BDS is certainly on the move around Europe and here. I mean, there have been significant victories. We went with Omar Barghouti, who gave us a breakdown of the cost of the Israeli economy now. It's beginning to be felt. So it's not just a symbolic thing. So all of that is happening. But the question is, how do you move all of that change in public opinion to a change in U.S. policy when it's really the military and our wars and the arms industry, which is behind so much of it, and especially now with terrorism as this bugbear, you know, the scariest thing in the world, if you would, you know, listen to the media, the most dangerous thing in the world, that is giving Israel a real lease of life. Yeah. Its emergence as the national security, you know, authority. So we have
and
a way
to go. And the Palestinians being the lab for new surveillance. And
exactly.
Jeff Halp has just written a book on that. I'm going to be dealing with that coming down the road, and he's coming in February. So I'm looking forward to that. Okay, now I want you to put on another hat, that of a participant and, in fact, one of the chief architects of the Boston Alliance for Water Justice. We've covered some of your activities on this week in Palestine, but quickly tell us, why should water justice be an issue for us in the Boston area, and how does it relate to Israel-Palestine?
Well, after we came back from my last IFPB, Interfaith Peacebuilding Tour, we had gone into the Negev Desert. We had been to places within Israel. These are Israeli citizens, but because they were not Jewish citizens, they were totally deprived of water. Those are the Arakib Bedouin, who, you know, Israel wanted to get rid of them, and so it didn't give them any water. Meanwhile, by the way, their houses have been demolished 90 times now. Meanwhile, eucalyptus trees are growing in the desert, and there's irrigation just to get rid of them and plant them over with eucalyptus trees. So we saw that as an example of water injustice. Everywhere we went in the West Bank, we heard similar stories of farmers not being able to irrigate, you know, having to leave their land fallow. And if you leave it fallow for 3 years, then Israel can take
That's
it
right.
as state land. In the camps, we saw, you know, places where water hadn't been turned on for more than, say, a few hours every week. You know, so we heard all these stories of water injustice. And we came back, this was 2 years ago, to read a story in the Boston Globe that on one of Deval Patrick's trips to Israel, he made a couple, they had, his administration had consummated a Israeli water Israeli-Massachusetts Innovative Water Partnership. And so that just seemed something we had to deal with. Here it is, a government, you know, embracing this right. water industry, saying this can save the world. You know, it's so advanced in its technology, and we knew that far from saving the world, it was destroying another people living next door to it with its water policy. So we started this. We actually got it to the point, now it's not probably all our doing, but I must say we were pleased to learn that the water partnership had been put on hold. We heard this just a few months ago, in October. Now, this could be a factor that the Deval-Patrick administration was no longer there. It could be certainly, you know, I'm sure we influenced with our public activity, our demonstrations, our pushback. But for whatever reason, it was put on hold. Now we learned that these 10 senators from the state Senate, that's a quarter of the state Senate, were going on a trip starting today, I believe, to
Senate. Leaving today.
To go and, you know, learn from Israel, learn from its technology, and in at least case of a few senators, learn from its water technology. And we thought, uh-oh, here we go again. They're going to go. It was supposedly planned before the October knife attacks and so on. So it's not supposed to be seen as we're standing behind you, Israel, but it is sponsored by the JCRC, the Jewish Community Relations Council, which has always, you know, been... It's a lobbying group that right before, or right as it was making arrangements to take these senators, it got the state Senate to vote on a resolution against Palestinians. You know, it's that kind of lobbying group.
Right, and they're paying for this trip.
And they're paying for the trip. Well, yeah.
Talk about conflict of interest.
Yeah, they say they got it's a grant from another group to pay for the trip.
Well, but
yeah, but they're organizing it. They've been sending, you know, any kind of community leaders, administrators, elected
and federal
officials.
Legislators, Catherine Clark, Elizabeth Warren have gone on these junkets.
Right. So we, the Boston Alliance for Water Justice, took this up as a junket, that's a good word for it, which will be used for propaganda purposes by the State of Israel, and which will be seen as an endorsement of the status quo. And it is our position that the status quo cannot be sustained, should not be sustained, and has to be, you know, revealed for what it is, which will not happen on such a trip, because it'll be a very partial look at what Israel is doing. So we had a petition, we had a press conference, we delivered messages, including messages from the Massachusetts residents who had been on the journey with me, and tried to say, don't go. Now, I'm not sure all of them are going, at least in one case. There was an interest in what we had to say. But we will pursue them on their return, and we have to figure out a strategy, what we really want to get out of this. But clearly, JCRC should not assume that it can take these trips in the future without there being significant pushback from the public.
Well, that's what's important here, I think. Yeah. We need to send a signal. We need to stop this kind of thing. And at least they should be embarrassed by this blatant conflict of interest,
Right. Really.
I mean, Right. Someone's paying your way.
You know, but this is after. So we get a new administration in, and there was a lot made out of the Patrick administration's foreign travel. You know, why aren't you staying home and doing the work of your constituents? And Baker, Governor Baker, had given an indication that he wouldn't be that sort of governor who would always be off on foreign travel. And yet when it was announced that these 10 senators were going, it was also said that he was considering going to Israel. And so we also went to see him, well, his staff, and gave them our messages. Because, you know, this is... The time is over to just be so blatantly one-sided and blind to the reality of what is happening in that region. Because what is happening in the region is leading both peoples to the edge of a cliff. It's going to make for a very dark future if we allow this to play out.
And Israel doesn't really see this. They don't see what's in their best interests.
No, well, because why should they? They can do this with impunity. The cost now, if it comes, will come through BDS. But they'll just say, oh, it's anti-Semitism and so on. But unless they are shown, it seems they have to be shown a truth about themselves and their behavior, which they have not been willing to face, which is they are really behaving in a way which one day history will judge them very harshly for what they're doing.
Well, they are becoming internationally a pariah state. They're very upset about this, and particularly upset about the fact that increasingly we are talking about the discrimination, the segregation in the Israeli society. We talk about an apartheid society. We talk about a Jim Crow. All of these are concepts that we understand in the United States, but have never really applied them to Israel. Certainly our government doesn't apply them, but our government, you know, our representatives would be appalled if we in a sense, tried to reinstitute the kind of segregation laws here that we've had in the past. They would be appalled. But yet we fund this segregated society, billions of dollars a year, and there doesn't seem to be any pushback.
You know, what really alarmed me, as it has been my more recent trips, is the extent to which they are able, and they have been able, to lay over Palestine, their map of Judea and Samaria.
Yeah.
I mean, it is eerie to drive along and to think you're on this road that just points to, you know, signposts pointing to Israeli settlements with no mention of any Palestinian villages living there. And, you know, it is as if they have, you know, got a blueprint in mind. This is what the West Bank's going to look like. Mm. And it isn't the West Bank, it is Judea and Samaria. And they are now creating it. It's almost like a Disneylandization of that land. And we went to talk with a settler spokesman in the settlement of Scott. Mm. And she, I mean, the way she talked about it, that was it. I mean, and this is not one of the original religious settlements. This was a settlement that when Sharon was Minister of Agriculture in, I think, 81, he wanted security settlements, mainly settlements around Ramallah in this case, to be able to block the growth of Ramallah. So it wasn't one of these Gush Emunim settlements, which, you know, people think, you know, this is our divine right. But she talked that language. I think that language is now shot through the settler movement. And they really do see this as a God-given blueprint to the land.
And it should come as no surprise, because the Zionist vision has always been take the land from the sea to the Jordan River, and the peace process has just been a charade to allow them time to do that very thing, take the land. That's what the settlement movement is all about, take the land. Yeah. Jordan Valley's gone, take the land. Yeah. And we're watching the vision play out.
We are watching it play out. But the question is, will, you know, the world stand by and not start bending the arc of history towards justice?
That's right.
And I think with BDS, I mean, there have been some very significant gains in Europe and even here, the AFL-CIO in Connecticut. Mm. In Europe, unfortunately, the EU just took a mini step towards saying, well, we have to label settlement products instead of saying ban settlement products. But, you know, that really put Israel on notice. And the sad thing is, now, it's like this, they're all terrorist mentality has also been played out on the landscape. So when you're driving along these roads, if there is a Palestinian city, they ignore the villages and the towns, but if there's a city, you get these giant red signs saying, danger, don't enter, Israelis are barred from entering there, it's a danger to your lives. I mean, the most inflammatory sign. Whereas every Israeli I know who did enter, say, Ramallah, or did enter Bethlehem, or did enter, you know, even Hebron, has been warmly welcomed if they come, you know, with the right intentions and not with a gun in their hands. Yeah. So
it's all part of the fear tactic.
Yeah, it certainly is.
It drives Israel and it drives us, frankly. Mm. Well, thank you, Nancy. We've unfortunately run out of time. We really appreciate your sitting down
with thank you.
This week in Palestine. You've been a guest before. I hope you will be in the future. And we particularly want to follow the exploits of the Boston Alliance for Water Justice. We think you're on to something. Thank you for all your good work.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
That was Nancy Murray, author, activist, and organizer, discussing her most recent trip to Palestine and her work with the Boston Alliance for Water Justice. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday when we will feature a conversation between Richard Falk, who served as UN Special Rapporteur on Palestinian Human Rights, and Ali Abu Nima of the Electronic Intifada. That is next Sunday morning. Please join us. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.